was the first sign of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And now they found the fossils that say that Ardipithecus is the first woman, first human being
mm-hmm.
in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we have to do is that recognize is that evolution is not only anatomical, but it's social and cultural.
Mm-hmm.
That we are now experiencing the collapse of industrial civilization.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, as Diamond points out in his book Collapse, collapses are not, they are suicidal. They are what people do when they maintain values that are
ecologically unsustainable. Wow.
And the United States is maintaining these three values.
The King railed on about racism, materialism, and militarism.
That's
King
right.
talks about that.
And what, where Obama needs to be challenged, because he has no sense of history,
yeah.
he needs to be challenged to understand that these are what make, he can't talk just about health
yeah.
and war and deal with these questions separately.
I wish I had been talking to you before I gave the talk at Abyssinia. You know, this is, you know, I mean, this is clearly pointed right in the direction where we need to be thinking.
That's right.
That's
why I made these notes for you. That's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
And the people recognize that, you know, this, we are really witnessing the collapse of the civilization.
Yeah, yeah.
And this woman, Carolyn Baker, who's in Colorado, calls it a sacred demise.
Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of, how the understanding, the thinking that we need, and the rituals that we need for this. You could think as an artist about this. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that you also have to understand that when a civilization crashes or collapses, all the institutions, the politics, the economics, the health, the education, everything fails.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody is looking for a new way to do these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that, and
I,
that,
I,
the,
yeah.
the, this, this book called Collapse by Diamond gives a very good example of how that happens. He says these people came from Norway to Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
They came with all the values that they had developed in Norway.
Mm-hmm.
They were not able to adapt themselves to the new climate.
Mm-hmm.
They kept eating meat, even though there's fish all around them.
Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
And what
mm-hmm.
they need to do is to start eating fish
yeah, exactly.
to adapt to their climate.
Yeah, exactly.
And to the circumstances. And we have not been able to do that. We've been thinking that we lived in an infinite
yeah.
universe. With
yeah.
infinite resources,
because yeah.
we started out
yeah.
with what we thought was empty land.
Yeah, yeah.
With all this, and now we've reached the point.
Yeah.
And that's where King was. He really understood that racism, materialism, and militarism was going to destroy us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's what a cultural revolution is.
Yeah, yeah.
When you get rid of the values that are no longer
applicable, no longer applicable, no longer.
If you continue, you commit suicide.
Yeah.
yeah. That's where this country is headed.
Yeah, yeah. And it's dragging the rest of the world in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
With it, it's taking the rest of the world with it.
Yeah.
But this period that we talk about is less than 200 years old. This period of capitalism in a sense. And so
well, on. Actually, it started in 1400. I mean, people began doing all sorts of things
yes.
as feudalism began collapsing.
Yeah.
You had the plague and so forth and so on.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And people's thinking began changing with scientific rationalism.
Yeah, exactly.
And they had the witch hunts, and they got rid of women's thinking.
Yeah.
And took the land away from the peasants.
Yeah.
I mean, and that happened the 17th century.
Yeah.
And the Industrial Revolution didn't really blossom until the 19th century.
Until the 19th century, yes,
yeah.
Yeah. But the thinking around the Enlightenment period, the whole self-governance,
yeah.
the idea of self-governance was a prelude to that.
Yeah, but the idea of self-governance came mainly from the Native Americans.
Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt.
The formation,
what I'm saying, the formation of those ideas, utilizing those ideas with respect to now this capital accumulation and the emergence of capitalism, you know, through science, technology, and et cetera, et cetera.
The reason why the Industrial Revolution took place in the West and not in China was because the Chinese did not adopt the Cartesian thinking, the objectification of reality. See, Cartesian thinking believes that time is reversible, whereas time is not reversible. It objectifies everything, turns everything into quantities. Anything that's not measurable is not real.
Mm. Okay, all right then. Yes, yeah. I'm with you on it. I'm following you on it.
So what I think really to understand this period is the collapse of that, and to understand it in very concrete terms, I think is what I've been feeling very strongly during this period. For example, at my birthday party, they made these t-shirts, and these t-shirts sold like hotcakes.
Yeah.
Because the young people understood that revolution is
it's evolution. Yeah, exactly.
And we have a copy of the
Revolution is evolution.
Revolution is evolution. And the artist captures it in this thing, this message.
Yeah.
And on this t-shirt.
Yeah. Right here.
Mm-hmm. So, what I did at my party was I began talking about how revolution has to be seen in terms of love rather than in terms of top down.
Exactly.
And then I wrote this thing here.
I read this one. I read this. Yeah, this one.
Then what happened was I was in Chicago in September. And we sold t-shirts like crazy. I mean, the young people just came in and they bought them. And Bill Ayers, whom you know, his mind changed to see the collapse in the educational system. Shortly thereafter, he invited me to come and speak to the President's Weekend, which is next February, where all these people who are looking for a new way of education are going to be gathering.
Wow.
And then there's going to be this huge convention in Denver, and he wants me and Vincent to be the main speakers.
This is when? February next year?
Next year.
Okay.
And the weekend in Denver, I think, is in March. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Now, what was very interesting is that I went to New York for the 60th anniversary of the Monthly Review.
Yeah, Monthly Review, yeah.
And we had...
I heard you on Democracy Now.
And I talked about how Einstein's socialism was more like Martin Luther King's
than
Marx's.
Yeah.
And I think what I found with Amy Goodman was that she kept emphasizing that I was a philosopher. Because I think she felt, I told her that, you know, that you better take it, step back, you know. You're doing too much.
Yeah, exactly.
And think more like a philosopher, get a longer view of what's happening.
Yeah.
And I think she understood that because she's a very sensitive person.
Yeah, she is very, very, very.
So, and everywhere that I was in New York, there were filmmakers, young filmmakers, all these kids, millennial generation, making films. And that, I mean, just felt, I don't know whether you feel that all over the place.
Well, I tell you, what's been amazing for me is just that, you know, everywhere in this country, but particularly as I go around the world, you know, and go to film festivals where you see these brilliant filmmakers. We were involved, my company, Louverture Films, was involved with a film that screened at the Cannes Film Festival, and it was supposed to be a major, major film screening. Ilya Suleiman, a Palestinian filmmaker, and people would say one of the best filmmakers in the world, and I wouldn't argue with him one bit. He had done a movie, filmed a movie, made a movie called Divine Intervention, which was supposed to have won one of the major awards, the Palme d'Or, 5 years ago at the Cannes Film Festival. But for some reason, they were told to go back in, the jury was told back to go back in, because they wouldn't allow that Palestinian film to be, you know, to win such a major award. Well, we became involved in this next film, The Time That Remains. Let me tell you, Grace, it's a masterpiece. It's funny, it's engaging, it's satirical, and everything else about his, from 1948, from a Palestinian point of view. That film was totally ignored. It got the longest standing ovation in the history of the Cannes Film Festival, over 5 minutes. It was ignored. The press wasn't there and everything else. Now, it was shown at the Toronto Film Festival, and it slotted in a position where it didn't get a lot of attention, because Cameron Bailey, the director of programming at the Toronto Film Festival, saw the movie in Cannes. But it was slotted in a way. But what overshadowed its presence was, as you know, what had happened was a number of people, including Naomi Klein, myself, and a number of artists, signed on to a petition, which we were questioning the fact that they have this thing, this city-to-city programming of films, and they picked Tel Aviv without picking any Palestinian filmmakers, and without even looking at Tel Aviv as some sort of glorious place, without placing in that the relationship or the situation of Palestine, never mentioning Gaza or whatever. It was a big promotional thing supported by the Israeli propaganda machine. Big promotional thing. And so what happened was a lot of us, the numbers were referred to now as fascists or Jew haters or people who didn't want the freedom of speech or whatever. And Naomi Klein has taken a big hit for that, you know. But in essence, his film, and then we were invited and been told we were in the New York Film Festival. And basically, all of a sudden, just removed from New York in the film festival. It's quite amazing, you know, in that sense. But the filmmaking around which we have a documentary that we're doing with a former member of the PLO that we're doing. It's a very, very wonderful documentary. We have another documentary that we've been working with in terms of filmmakers, a story about the role that a film, an Algerian film for the Algerian director, a story called Free Man, a story about the role that Muslims played in sheltering Jews in the mosque during the Vichy regime. And it's crazy because it deals with fascism, the war against the anti-fascists, deals with issues around decolonization. Really wonderful film. And those are the kind of things, because you see that kind of activity happening everywhere, you know. And that, I mean, to see it emerge here, and particularly under the climate, as we talk about the collapse here, the collapsing of this, I think a lot of these filmmakers are going to find ways in which they're going to be able to kind of be the kind of forefront, as he said to me, it's going to take artists to save us from the machines, mm-hmm. You know. So it's going to be. It's exciting. Yeah. I mean, it's the most exciting period in my career right now.
All right. Well, this is the most exciting time. Now I want to talk to you about Africa,
okay.
C.L.R. James, because I understand Rick says you want to do a film about Black Jacobins. So you've been thinking about it.
I've written a script, not based upon Black Jacobins. It's based the catalyst, the reason why it was, I didn't know about the Haitian Revolution, so I read Black Jacobins at about 1971. I read Black Jacobins when I was a student, and I was blown away by that. So of course, the idea of being an actor wasn't even part of my dream memory or whatever at that time. But as I, for about the last 25 years, I've been trying to do a script on the Haitian Revolution. And we put it together, the script. We, over the last 10 years ago now, we've had a script for 4 years. And the focus of our script are looking at two worldviews, one of traditionalism and one of modernity. The other focus of our script is that what does it mean for a slave, what does freedom mean for a slave? And I said, so a lot of the themes around this center around the story, focusing on Toussaint specifically, because Toussaint being the thinker or the basically the one who was able to militarily and philosophically begin to shape the Haitian Revolution.
Well, that's what I want to talk to you about.
Okay.
I saw a production of Black Jacobins in London in 1986 when I went there to London declared a week in celebration of C.L.R. James.
Okay.
And I went there to speak. The production was terrible.
Yeah, okay.
What has happened since in this last period is that people like Wangiri Maathai, the women, have been able to point out that the intellectuals of the 60s, the West Indian and the African American and the English, the African, people like Padmore and C.L.R. James, and people who had been educated here, like Nkrumah, had a very limited view of Africa.
Okay.
That their view of Africa was essentially that of the nation state.
Okay.
And Nkrumah thought that if he just took control of politics, he would be able to do everything.
Absolutely.
They didn't recognize that they were thinking within the colonialist mentality and operating within the colonialist space.
Okay.
A book has just been written.
Right here.
Ending British Rule in Africa.
Ending British Rule.
By a woman at the University of Indiana who came to me and she refers to how at the very last moment as she was completing her book, I talked to her about the limitations of that generation of leadership.
Okay, okay.
And she said she was able to understand that we have to look at those limitations in the light of the context of the time and how they were unable, that the independence movement was just beginning, like the black movement was just beginning.
Yeah.
And what has happened since is that this woman, operating from the point of view of a woman, from the environment.
Okay.
And she's the one who got the Peace Prize.
Well, I know Wangari.
All right.
She
has been able to talk about going back to what she calls the micronations, to the culture of the tribes, and to recognize that they lived in harmony with their environment. And because she proceeds from the perspective of the women, which the guys who took over in the 60s never did. They were thinking more in terms of the cities than of the rural economy. And they were operating in a period when it looked like the global north was in great shape. And they were trying to catch up with the global north. And today we're in a very different circumstance where the global north is in trouble.
Yeah.
And we have to think very differently about the culture before slavery and before colonialism. And what's very interesting is that I'm having a Selma James, C.L.R. James's widow.
Yeah.
and a woman who worked very closely with Walter Rodney
yeah.
are coming here in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
And we're going to have a conference around the question of how do we look at Africa today?
Mm-hmm.
And what Rodney points out is how before slave trade and before colonialism, we had communalism
mm-hmm.
where the family and kinship
mm-hmm.
were the main basis of the society.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's absolutely. The way we have to begin thinking now
absolutely.
With
absolutely.
The collapse of industrial society.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And I think that you have to look at whatever you decide to do in terms of a film now about the Black Jacobins, about Haiti, in that light, and to understand that what when Paul Rosen played in the film, which he did, he played in C.L.R. James's play.
Yeah, he did that travel around.
That was another period.
I mean, well, that's, I think, because the writer of my script is a woman,
uh-huh.
is a woman, my producing partner. I think the aspects of what you talk about, because those are represented in very clear ways through, first of all, one, through Toussaint, who is a you know, Toussaint, in a sense, is someone who is attracted by to the aspects of development and the aspect, the colonial, maintenance of the colonial state itself, the state, the colony itself, you know, through his ideas of modernity. And yet, his nephew is the other, maybe one of the major conflicts in this is his nephew, who is traditionalism, along with the storyteller is Fatima, who is the Maroon priestess, who is not only clairvoyant, but also is able to kind of be able to look into the future and prophetic. So that's our storyteller.
Oh,
that's our storyteller. We begin with Fatima. She's central to the piece. We said Fatima is the central piece in this because she, in a sense, Maroons who had lived in the mountains, who had escaped slavery, and who lived and had a certain kind of sensibility and life of their own life itself. You know, she becomes a key point in that, in the story, both in the ways which are material in real ways, but also in the ways in which are translated through her own spiritualism or through her own sense of traditionalism. So those are the two pillars that we base this film on. This is not about men stepping up and sitting up and doing these great oratory kind of speeches. This is about the struggle. And Toussaint realizing at the end that when he executes, Toussaint executes his nephew, his adopted nephew, because Toussaint means Moise leads a revolt of farmers against him and is captured then because they refuse to continue to live this in existence within this colonial structure. He's captured then. But interesting, in the scene where we see Moise, it's that scene in I took a little liberty from that scene in Ilya Kazan's Viva Zapata. There's a scene where we see, there's two scenes which really makes the film very interesting to me. The scene where at the beginning of his ascension, Zapata has this group of farmers who kind of, as he marches to deal with the empire and their authority, this group of farmers that follow him as he goes up here in a revolt. Took a little liberty with that, and took a little plagiarism with that scene, because I thought it was a brilliant scene. And the other scene was when he's sitting there and he sees someone comes up there and who tells him his story, and he's reminded of who he is. This is when he has authority and takes off the thing and walks away from that, which is basically one of the same scenes in Burn, the Cantabarro. Viva Cantabarro film about with Marlon Brando, where Jesus Dolores the guy who's led to, who Brando targets is to lead the revolt and leads the revolt, and he comes to see that all this idea of change is not what change is, and it goes out and says, "I'm leaving, but if you turn on us, I'm gonna revolt again." And then Brando comes back, and finds himself in pursuit of him. You know, so the idea is that we've placed this film in this kind of context to ask about, because I think the film is important. One, because it's the first victory of Africans in the institution of slavery. Two, that it demonstrates to people the power that we have to fight empire. It's the first victory against empire as well. So in some sense, it's important from that vantage point, but it's also important from the other values that I think are important. The one where this dynamic of struggle between traditional values, the values which are friendly to the mother planet, the values that, and because we live in harmony with the mother planet, to those values of modernity and progress and mm-hmm. development, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is a key point. And that's what we, and then what does it mean in the final question, what does it mean to be free? What is freedom, in a sense?
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's how we've shaped the story. Yeah, that's how we've developed the story. And we've developed the story from scratch. We had no, I mean, this journey for doing a story on the Haitian Revolution has been some sort of journey that's been over 30 years for me, you know, and it began to manifest itself in some way through projects that we had done. And when, after I finished Color Purple, that was now 24 years ago, I went to Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg had wanted me, he was thinking about doing Alexander the Great, and he wanted me to play an Egyptian general in it, you know. I thought it was a great idea, maybe playing Egyptian general in Arizona. But I talked with him about the Haitian slave revolt. But I think he felt that Amistad was the thing he wanted to do, Amistad, you know. But we've developed this thing. We've developed it, of course, when people are saying it's got to have a white person here and a white person there and whatever. We developed it. Where, and the reason why we're having a difficult time, this has been a white story. It had been done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But it's a story where you have people of color challenging empire, you know, and so that's the direction. So Black Jacobins is only the cover, as the thing to say. Boy, there was for me at 24 years old, there was a Haitian Revolution and I didn't know about it. There was this incredible thing that happened and these incredible men and women that this thing happened and I didn't ever heard about it. So it has been the impetus for this, in a sense, you know. And then, and it's like, it's an incredible story in itself.
Well, I'm very glad to hear that you're doing it in terms of the traditional presence.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. These are the two pillars around mm-hmm. traditionalism and modernity, you know. And Moïse is this strong kid who comes, young man, who aspires because of his bravery and everything else. But more and more he's drawn to the traditional values, farmers, their lives, you know, and everything else. And he sees what is happening in the midst of this quote-unquote victory, you know. As it turned out, Christophe represented that part of modernity. In one scene we have with Christophe is singing, I think you should copy the script, Christophe has the kids singing what every French, if you've been in a French colony of Cumber French, I am a son of the Gauls, I am from the Gauls, it seems that, and then Toussaint comes in here and says, that doesn't seem right, but in that sense, you have Dessalines, who's leaning in some way, but he's in that camp of somewhat traditionalism. But the pure person, the purity of that lies in Moïse, the son, who eventually, after leading that revolt of farmers and soldiers against Toussaint says, "Kiss him." You know. And at the end of the play, we have this moment where he realizes his failure. You know, that he realizes that becomes the last time before we open the film. With this, we open the film with Fatima's voice, and she talks about the history of Haiti, Tiano. Then we look and we find the buttons. We just said at the Cooper Museum, the buttons that that had been given to Toussaint by the general who comes to defeat him, but becomes his ally. I'm losing it right now. But we open the scene with that, and then we see his face at the last moments of death, because he freezes to death. Napoleon puts him in prison, he freezes to death. We see him, so then we go back to the night of fire. Then we have him come through the encampment where he sees women and men drinking rum, and everything seems to be just out of disarray. This is after the revolt. So he brings order to the revolt. He's the one that organizes the revolt in such a way. He trains the soldiers, and does everything, organizes the war, defeats the Spanish, you know, makes an alliance with the Spanish, then defeats the Spanish, and then makes an alliance with the French. And then that's when Frontenac abolishes slavery. His decree abolished slavery in Haiti right there, 1793. So he does that, he goes from that point on through this whole plans of pseudo statehood or whatever and everything else. Then he decides now that he was going to now control and take over the whole island of Hispaniola, the whole island which included the Dominican Republic, etc. So he becomes that particular point. Then he comes back and realizes, just as Napoleon comes to power, that he has another adversary, you know, and he tells Napoleon something: you may be the first among whites, but I'm the first among black. Napoleon sends a secret, sends Sinclair, his brother-in-law, married to Pauline, sends his brother-in-law to Haiti, not simply just to crush the rebellion and replace the generals, but it's in a secret order, but using Haiti as the staging ground to now reassert themselves in the Americas. And the fact that the Haitians defeated them is the reason why, desperate for money, he sells the Louisiana Purchase for $13 million. Jefferson only was enamored with New Orleans, but they got the whole community and everything else. So we don't go in that part of it, when we take it up to, for those 12 years, 1791 to 1803, of the years, which thrusts Toussaint from a 47-year-old coachman to some who dies at 60 years old in the French Alps. Yeah.
So what stage is this?
Well, what happened is we finally got the script. First of all, we figured, where's the best place to shoot this movie? Where politically is the best place to shoot the movie? So we knew that South Africa had a fund, or South Africa was in the business of doing movies. So they have the industrial, the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation. And so about 2000, after trying to raise money, 2005, 2004, we started meeting with a various film festival with people from the IDC. We figured we schemed up a plan where if we got 30% from South Africa, we got 30% leverage that 30% by a Ingenious, a company in the UK, because South Africa and the UK had signed a production deal, co-production deal, and so we do that. Then we go and arrange the other 30%. It's a $30 million film. If I do this in L.A., in Hollywood, in the studio, it's a $75, $80 million film. So we go to Ingenious. In fact, we get all our heads of departments or people who are really wonderful at what they do in the U.K. Remy Adafarison, who is our cinematographer, who's of Nigerian descent. He shot Elizabeth, both Elizabeths, And then he did a couple of Woody Allen films out here. But he is working in Elizabeth, and he shot Band of Brothers for HBO, which he won an Emmy for. His work is exquisite. We wanted to work with him. Consolata Boyle, as a wardrobe person, is an incredible wardrobe. She's done most of Stephen Sears' movies, from Dangerous Liaisons to On. She's done that. So we got someone, period. We got someone that we wanted to do that. And we began to work, and that's in putting our, we got Michael Carlin, who got an Oscar nomination this last year, but had just finished, when we contacted him, just finished The Last King of Scotland. He's a guy who can find ways in which he can, you know, get to doing what it needs to be done. So we had three key people, and often our heads of departments, AHDs. We got three people that we wanted to get. So then what we did was we talking to the IDC, trying to find ways, talking to Ingenious in the UK and everything else. So, and this is all on my dime, you know, development of the script, all this stuff on my dime. It's been a long journey, but I figured the only way I was going to get this script done and get the story I want was putting my mouth where my money was, you know. My money was my mouth was. And so we did all that. Then we went to do location scouting. And we figured out that we were going to try to do it. This is about 2,000 kilometers from Maputo, Mozambique. There's a little island called Ilha Mozambique. And on that is a 16th century Portuguese fort. So we were going to use that as the center base, use the island in itself. But the island was so undeveloped that we had to scrap that to most part. Because it was so undeveloped, we'd had to put a water system in. It only had accommodations of about 60 people on the island itself. It was a beautiful do that. We'd have to bring in a cruise ship or someplace to house people offshore. All those things added about $3 million to the budget. So, and then we went all the way, I traveled all the way up down the KwaZulu-Natal. We found sugar cane. Okay, we may have a problem. Now we're going to have to do some sort of visual enhancement to get the kind of scenery, to get the look of the Spanish town, to get the look of Port-au-Prince, or to get the look of Leclerc, you know, the three towns that we needed. So we did all that work and everything else and set up an office there at the end of 2006. Set up an office there. None of that came through because the one thing we could not get, and we couldn't get foreign sales estimates for a film because of the cast and the genre. Not because of the genre, because the cast was all black. We went to every single one, every single we wanted. We went to Pathé. I had done a film with them. We went to Wild Bunch. We went to all over Europe trying to get a foreign sales estimate. You know, but nobody would give it to us. You know, I even went to Mel.